We're at episode 22. That's where the question mark. I'm talking to Nick Issa. How you going?
I'm well, mate. How are you?
I'm all right. And Nick's sent through his six songs, and he's made it clear to me that already that they're not his favourite songs, but each song tells a story. And I said, that's good, because it's the worst list of songs I've ever seen.
Yeah, I bet you. Big sigh of relief for you.
Yeah, it's like I'm friends with this guy who these are his six. Oh, that's not true. There's some great songs in here, and some in particular that
I knew when I came up with the list.
Yeah,
I knew when I came up with the list. I looked at it and I thought, he's just going to shake his head and go, why did I ask this guy to come onto this podcast?
Yeah. I mean, in general, it's yeah. There's stories behind it. There's one or two where I was like, all right.
You want to start with those?
Well, no. You gave me a list of order. We'll start with Killing in the Name of Rage Against the Machine. Before we do, Nick's a teacher as well, so cross that off your bingo card of yet another teacher on the podcast.
Another teacher.
So you've got Killing in the Name of Rage Against the Machine.
Yeah. Absolute anthem. Universal anthem, really.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're the same age as me to like a week.
Yep.
Week difference.
Yep.
How old were we? 14? 13, 14?
When yeah, would have been, yeah. Yep. Early 90s, 91, 92 came out.
Yeah, and just the fact that it had lots of swearing in it.
Well, see, this is the thing. I knew the radio version. I actually fell in love with the riff.
Yeah.
It wasn't the fact that it had that amazing end to the song. I didn't know that end of the song actually existed till 95, 96,
yeah,
when I actually bought the album. So it was always the Rage version.
Yeah.
On ABC. And so they always cut that last bit out, obviously for the sake of censorship. Yeah.
Huh.
So I actually fell in love with the song.
Yeah.
Because of the riff. And then I got the album and I put it in.
Yeah.
CD and listened to it and oh my fucking God.
Yeah.
There's this whole other thing to it that I didn't even know existed until after. And then I fell in love with it again. And it just ended up being the song that represented exactly how I felt.
I was going to say, were you an angry young man?
Yeah, I was a teenager who was feeling very keenly a lot of injustices going on around me.
Yeah.
Not directly about me personally, but my family emigrated over here.
Yeah, when did they emigrate?
My dad came over in 75
from
Lebanon.
From Lebanon.
And then everyone followed in 77. And he went back, got married. So him and mum came over in 77, the rest of his family, my grandparents and my uncles and aunts.
Yeah.
And I was born in 78, and basically they've never been back since. You know, pretty much as soon as I was born, that was it. So they.
So you're the eldest?
Yeah.
The eldest of four, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
So I've got two younger sisters and a younger brother. But my uncle was my uncle who. They came out of the Civil War in Lebanon. And my uncle kept these diaries. You know, it was like a scrapbook diary.
Cool.
And every time there were clippings about Lebanon and the war and certain battles that were going on, he'd get those clippings writing. But what he did was he would talk about how Australia's media was always telling the story quite with a bias.
Yeah.
And was feeding this bias through. And he would highlight things and show me other clippings where that was contradicted, or he would talk about what our family back there was saying was happening.
Yeah.
And it never married. And there was always some kind of agenda behind it. And I started reading in that way.
Yeah.
And the more I read that way, the angrier I got. Because I thought, why won't anybody tell the truth?
Yeah.
And then with that, I guess, built up a lot of other things of being, you know, a WOG, being an ethnic at a school. And I was effectively the first ethnic at that school. I mean, I had no one to really talk to about some of this stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just a frustrating period. And then this song came along. And initially, like I said, I just liked the riff. It was just a tune that I liked. But when I actually discovered the album and the song properly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, have you ever seen the movie About a Boy or read the book?
Yeah.
It's like when the kid goes, you know, he swore when I told him about how life is shit.
Yeah.
And that made me feel better. That's kind of what that song did.
Yeah, it just made you feel better.
It just made me feel better. It's like, cool. All right, I've got this expression for it.
And yeah. So getting back to like school, when it came out and you're 14 or you, even later, so you said before that you were like the lone wog, did you say, in your school?
Yeah, my school opened. It was a primary school, high school combo.
Yeah.
Primary school.
This is in Melbourne?
Yeah, this is Craigieburn, or as we call it, Crazyburn.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first suburb you hit when you drive the Hume Highway into Melbourne.
Okay.
Okay, so it's the one just over the hill there. And when the school opened, yeah, it was pretty much a typical Australian working class sort of town, 1,800 people.
Okay.
And I mean, I was the first ethnic with probably two other guys. There was one other guy who was half Greek, half Palestinian, and an Italian bloke.
Yeah.
And an Italian bloke and I actually ended up being best mates through high school. And yeah, the rest were just working class, Aussie, great people.
Yeah. You know?
But it was strange. It was weird. You're singled out and isolated simply because you had food that was different, you know, because your skin colour was different. You just had different values or stupid things like Easter being a different date.
Yeah.
Singled you out. Because, you know, the Catholic Easter, which is, I think, the lunar cycle.
Yeah.
Where the Orthodox, my family are Orthodox, we had a set date. So every 4 years, I think it was, we had the same date, Easter.
Okay.
Every other time, you know, Easter holidays for one, and then my Easter would happen 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks after. So, and things like that just made it very lonely for a lot of that. And not only that, but you got picked on because that's what kids do. And,
yeah.
I don't know if you've picked this up about me, but I sometimes bite back, and I have a bit of a mouth on me, and I also had a couple of fists. So, yeah. You know, it was quite a... I almost say a vicious cycle, but it was a constant cycle.
Yeah.
Where you just pick, and then next thing I know, I'm in the deputy principal's office talking about another fight that I've been in, and on you go. So
when you went into the deputy principal's office and they talked to you about, like, you've been in a fight, when you explained to them why you got into a fight, did they, what did they do then? Did they go, we don't care, like, no fighting, or did they go, well,
we had a couple of instances. I mean, I was actually academically quite a good kid.
Yeah.
So you got the guilt trip of, this is not what we expect from you, mm-hmm. Nick. We got the...
Use your words.
Yeah. They would... I mean, there are often programs and things that I was signed up to because I was gifted and talented. Well, I don't know what the version of it was back then. And so doing those things meant that I was also responsible, you know, and had responsibility. So they would always use that against me, actually, in their discussions. This is not what we expect of someone who's in the, you know, the advanced programs or who's, you know, going for scholarships from blah, 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 whatever.
Yeah.
You know, we expect better behavior from this. You know, it's not what we, you know, we're not putting your name forward as a representative of the school if this is the kind of behavior you're going to conduct and you know, perform at school.
And did you just go, you, I want to do what you tell me? Or did you...
Well, yeah, if I knew the song earlier, maybe.
was there a cleaner version when they were like, hot damn, I won't do what you tell me, or something
maybe
like that.
Yeah, maybe. I shall consider your words and then ignore them later.
What about, we might crack on to the next one because, you know, AC/DC, Hell's Bells.
Yeah, Hell's Bells. This was an identity, belonging thing. You know, this sort of links in really well with Killing a Name. I was a latecomer to music, and my uncle, who was the same person that was doing the scrapbook stuff, he was my hero, basically.
Yeah.
And I stumbled across a cassette, and I put it in, and it was Back in Black.
Yeah.
And having my uncle like and own a Back in Black AC/DC made me just love AC/DC.
Yeah.
And the minute I started loving AC/DC, I had one of those little ins to actually talk to these school friends, these school people that I was going to school,
yeah.
Who were quite different to me in every other way possible. And so all of a sudden, I'm talking about Akadaka.
Yeah.
I mean,
you write it on your folder and that's it.
Yeah, that's right. And you do that little fancy little diamond thing at the end of each letter and all that stuff. And, you know, you don't even write the letters. You just put the thunderbolt. And,
yeah.
You know, you're part of a cult. And, yeah, it was my first small step into becoming a Bogan. Effectively, and it's quite an important thing. Yeah, we laugh about it, but it, like I said, it gave me an in to actually settle in school.
Yeah.
But Hell's Bells, the song, like you probably had this. I'm sure everyone has had this moment where the first string of a guitar or the first sound of a song, those bells just gave me goosebumps.
Yeah.
And it's just one of those lasting effects that every time I hear those bells,
that was the first time you heard it, you remember. Yeah.
And it's just, and just that opening riff that went with it, it just was dark, it was moody, and it just gave me the shivers. And I thought, I could listen to this song, and I have done for decades, and never be sick of it. And so, two things, the song itself was just awesome, it was just an awesome song. And it was interesting, I listened to, I think it was Brian Johnson talk about it. Afterwards, the albums contain mistakes.
Yeah.
And there's a pretty significant mistake, I think, in Hell's Bells with a drum sequence, just sort of midway, just after in and around the solo. And when I realized that that was the case, I loved it even more. I thought, great, it's not this, you know, overproduced, you know, crap that we get today with music.
Yeah.
It's just, this is honest rock. And all that stuff sort of just resonated. And I thought, yeah, this is awesome. And then I could talk about it to guys who, you know, listen and play music at school, and, you know, you could actually go into that discussion. So, yeah, like I said, it was that in at school, but also it was just the shivers up your spine. I mean, it was just an awesome song.
Do you have any other songs that, like, have that? Because, I mean,
there's a few, yeah.
It's like the first time you hear it, you're like, that's pretty spot on.
Yeah, there's another one on the list that is on there for that reason, too. It's the ABC remix.
Okay, yeah. Angela Mine, yeah.
Yeah, and probably, yeah, one or two others. I think Stairway to Heaven did that.
Yeah.
Probably not in the same vein. Painted Black by the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, that's
there was something really strong about that. That just hooked you in.
When I lived in Japan, that was... there's something weird about that song. Every time I listen to it, I feel the same thing. But in Japan, like, a lot of... socializing is drinking a lot and then going karaoke and singing it. And that song always kind of freaked me out by its intensity.
Yeah.
Everyone would get into it, like, even with, like, everyone's wasted and they get into the tambourines and then you're like, this is like an acid trip. Every time, like, every time.
Yeah.
You sort of, it builds to, like, especially that last bit. Yeah, I was always like, even listening to it in the car, I'm always like, I love the last, like, third of that song.
Absolutely. And they just resonate, and you can you pick up a tune, and you've heard them probably hum up and down the corridors at work. It's just, they're the songs that you're humming usually, and just I don't know why. There's no rhyme or reason why I'd be playing, you know, Painted Black or Fade to Black by Metallica.
Yeah,
you know, there's no other reason, but they're just they're in my head. They're always going to be, and every time I hear those tunes, it's just, I almost stop everything and just listen, because it's just it's one of those things that you just love about music. It's just, it just connects.
Yeah, it's instant, isn't it?
Yeah. And, yeah, the intensity, whether it's the intensity, the lyrics sometimes. For me, it's always been the drum beat.
Yeah.
I can see there's a drum kit set up just over here. And,
yeah. That's your drum kit?
That is my drum kit. That's the thing I annoy the neighbours with. But, yeah, there's always something about the beat and the kind of hook with the riff.
Yeah.
Like Hell's Bells, going back to the song. Once you're hooked in, like it just doesn't let you go.
Yeah.
And you just take it on, and it's just an awesome ride. Especially when you're 13, 14, and you're coming across music that you weren't expecting, one, your uncle, your family to be into, because they're all Arab, Lebo, you know, they all listen to Lebanese music. And I can't even understand what they're talking about. But, you know, and then there's this cassette, and then this first song, it's the first song on the album.
Yeah.
It's just like, that's it. There's no way it's letting me go. And it's just brilliant.
It's interesting what you said, though, about how it was like you're into Bogan culture.
Yeah.
I have no concept of what that struggle would have been like.
You know,
was it like a relief, like a relief, or was it just like
it was?
You didn't notice it at the time.
Like I said, it was my first step, and very quickly after that, there was a number of steps that sort of came with it. So, yeah, it was relief. I think it was relief, but there's also this, this sense of actually of worth.
Yeah.
As much, you know, that people actually valued finally what I had to say.
Yeah.
And I was actually saying this to a group, I think it's last week actually, where what actually happened was that AC/DC opened up doors to other things that I always liked but wasn't able to really express. AFL football was one.
Yeah.
And the most significant thing was AFL football, really, because I got on the field and could play the game. And every now and then you just come across something that you just can do.
Yeah.
You sit down, you can just do it. I just got onto the football field and I just could play.
Yeah.
Because for years, I'd watched the football with my dad and it just all sunk in. I never played the game, but I just knew what was going on and how he played it. And then I got on the field and I smashed it. And all that stuff started to open up all these people and they actually started seeing me for actually who I was.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I was into Collingwood, love playing the game. I could talk about it for hours on end.
Yeah.
I could, you know, I'd do the stupid thing of having a sock and I'd have mock games in my bedroom where I've got two teams. I'd write the teams out on a sheet.
Yeah.
And I'd play. So I actually knew every name of every player in the leagues from 92 through to 98 or whatever. Because I was playing these games and I just was into it. Had AC/DC so I could talk about music. And then all of a sudden, it went from me having to basically fight between classes
you
know, because someone said something or someone did something. And I had two younger sisters and a younger brother and I was always protective of them to, you know, you're the first one picked to play a lunchtime football.
Yeah.
You're the captain. You know, who's going to play on your side? All of a sudden, I was getting asked to join people.
Yeah.
I had girls, I was saying this, I had girls actually call me by my name, you know, instead of Lebo.
That was your nickname?
Yeah. I was Lebo. I was the only Lebo in the school.
Right? Yeah.
So, and for that too, you have no idea how big, I think you would, but I don't think people know how big a deal that can be for a young teenage boy.
Yeah.
That just girls knowing your name and actually showing you attention.
Not calling you Lebo.
Yeah. It was a massive change.
Yeah.
To the point where I was trying to grow a curly haired mullet. It was the most horrendous thing. Most horrendous thing you'll ever see. I'm pretty sure I got photos still from that. It was just, yeah, and I was standing in front
of how old? How old?
Yeah, probably about 13, 14, then through to about 16, until I hit year 10, and then I sort of woke up to myself.
But I came late to the mullet, I had a horrid mullet.
Yeah, but I would stand in front of the mirror, and you know what I would do? I would try and tug it down.
Groomy mullet.
Because the curls would make it go disappear back up behind my ears.
So yeah, I've got the same thing.
Pull it down. You know, it's like. So I love when it rained. Yeah. I'd run out and rain because when it rained, your hair goes straight. So all the hair went down the back. I was like, yeah, cool. How cool am I?
Now I've got the mullet. I can play AFL footy. I'm listening to Hell's Bells.
Yeah, it was
Aussie Az.
Aussie Az. We can mock the whole Bogan thing, but for me, it was quite important.
I honestly, you look at what Bogan is, and it's pretty Australian.
Yeah.
Like this, most people who would identify themselves as Australian would be able to tick off a whole lot of what are known as Boganisms, aren't they?
Yeah.
Right. Easy.
Yeah. And I've done that a number of times, and, yeah. and people have listed things, and they go, oh, I'm into that. And my brother yeah. accuses me of being a bogan more than any other person I know. but, you know, that's okay, because he's gay.
Yeah.
So I've got plenty of ammunition to throw back at him. So it's all good. But, yeah, I mean, it was just the... I say this to people a lot, that, you know, I was really lucky. If I go back and put myself back in that time, I think it was a hard time, especially initially in the early years, year 7, 8 sort of period. But I wouldn't have it again. I wouldn't have it any differently, because I had the great balance of this Australianism,
yeah.
this life at school, and my very, very Lebanese upbringing at home.
Yeah.
You know, and at the time it was actually quite hard to juggle because I was not allowed to do anything.
Yeah.
You know, I had to wrestle my dad for quite a while for him to let me play local football.
Okay.
You know, and it took me bringing over all of my friends and having about 4 or 5 boys on my door telling my dad we really need Nick to play.
Yeah.
You know, it was that kind of thing. So, and I had that competing with, you know, ACDC and mullets and AFL and girls and, you know, meat pies and, you know, meat pie, pita bread, you know.
Yeah.
Tomato sauce. What is this horrendous thing that you call tomato sauce? Why would you ruin food with tomato sauce? You guys insane? What's going on? And, yeah, so you had that juggle right through.
Yeah.
And I still had to learn about history and science and maths and be gifted and talented and get these special programs and scholarships and try not to beat up the guy that was making fun of my curly head model. You know, just that was school.
It's pretty exhausting.
Yeah.
As a teacher, yeah. I know as well.
Yeah.
Well, can we... I just looked at the list, and if we're talking bogan, we're talking mullets, we're talking football, you've got Kaysan on here, man.
I do have Kaysan.
That was hard to take. That was the thing I went...
I don't want to do this anymore.
This is my one of my good friends, and one of his 6 favourite songs of all time is Kaysan by Chisel.
Favourite is a loose term.
Yeah.
I wouldn't take that too seriously. Big pinch of salt.
Yeah.
But Kaysan is a significant song because it probably represents a very dark, probably arguably the darkest period of my life. And it stems from my football years.
Yeah.
And again, it goes back to belonging and all that stuff. And when I play AFL, when I was playing AFL, I was 16, 17, I was actually quite good for my level. You know, the senior open side, men's side, had me playing for them, and I was leading goal kicker for the first 7 or 8 games. But they weren't playing me from the start of the game. I was coming off the bench,
yeah.
and I was doing everything. I was training as much as I could have trained. I was doing everything the coach said. I was getting on the field and making an impact every time. I was playing out of the forward pocket up into, you know, half forward wing. I was fit. I was doing everything right.
Yeah.
So I didn't understand why I wasn't getting a start. And I went to my best mate, who also was playing in the team. I go, why? I mean, I'm doing everything you are. And he's getting the starts. So, you know, what's happened? What's going on? Have I done something? And his response was that they didn't trust me.
Uh-huh.
And they didn't trust me because I wasn't getting drunk with them.
Yeah.
And because I wasn't drinking, and drinking wasn't a part of my family at all.
Yeah.
We'd have a spirit drink every festival, or, you know. But just drinking wasn't part of my thing at all. So so he said, yeah, that if you're not drinking with them, they're not going to trust you. And if they're not going to trust you, you probably won't get the breaks like everyone else was.
It's a weird part of football culture, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, and that's my first real take of it. Because, I mean, it was just football up until that point. Like, I wasn't really involved with all the other functions and stuff that happened around the football club. And I took that on because football was everything. Like, really, it just represented everything in my life. So, very next weekend, bowl of Southern Comfort, some stupid drinking game, and I was hugging a toilet bowl for, you know, half the night. And that was my step into that culture.
And he's ready to play.
Yeah.
He's ready to play senior football.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You know, let's put him in the midfield. I don't care how hungover he is. Just go for the middle ball. But yeah, I was getting to the social life of it all. I was getting pissed every Saturday night. Sometimes I get pissed on a Friday night before the game.
Yeah.
And you know, I was introduced to strippers. I was introduced to gambling. You know, marijuana. I mean, everything that 16, 17-year-olds probably shouldn't be introduced to was just there laid out on the pool table, you know? So And that led into, you know, my VCE year, or HSC as you call it over here, or whatever you call it over here. And it culminated at UC. You know, around 2000, I decided I needed to leave home, needed to leave Melbourne, just readjust.
Yeah.
But the drinking culture here, UC, living on campus, was even stronger.
Yeah, living on campus is something I never did, but the people who did...
And
it's pretty tough.
I can tell you about people who were quite normal, straight-thinking, young teenagers with lots of dreams and hopes and whatever else you want to call it, and they've left 3 years later, and they're just blobs, absolute drips, you know. And you know, it's completely done the reverse. You know, the tertiary education thing, that whole experience was supposed to propel you forward.
Yeah.
A lot of these people were starting to dig their own graves, really. And I was probably... on that track.
Yeah.
Again, football, now joined up with the UC football team. And the drinking culture just pretty much just overwhelms you. And what happened was that this is probably 2001. I was doing okay academically. I was doing much better than I was when I was in Melbourne. I had these two very beautiful American exchange girls come over. And, my mate and I had our eyes on him, and he dug the redhead and I dug the blonde. And it just so happened that we were drinking, the interest was, you know, returned, we knew we were in, and you get to that point, you're drunk enough that you start doing dares and stupid things like that. And I was hoping we were going to play spin the bottle. That was my ambition. It ended up being that they dared us. Yeah. They end up daring us to just do all stupid things. And one of the stupid things they dared us to do was to drink a capful of Dynamo laundry detergent. Sure, why not? Capful, downed it, mate downed it. He was fine. Ended up going home with a redhead.
Yeah.
I spent 2 nights in hospital.
2 nights in hospital?
Yeah, because I had some kind of stunning reaction. I passed out.
You drank low detergent?
And you know, you frothy mouth, you just weren't breathing properly, ambulance was called in.
So the other guy was fine.
The other guy was fine.
That's more of the surprise.
Yeah, the other guy was fine. And I had to get my, you know, stomach sort of pumped and everything else out of it, and just they monitored me for 2 nights just to make sure that I was okay. And I came out of it. And I came out of it going, what the fuck are you doing with your life?
Yeah.
What are you doing? The reason why you're here in Canberra in the first place was to get away from this shit, and here you are again.
Yeah.
And pretty much from there on, alcohol ceased to be a significant part of my life.
Yeah.
The whole thing was around alcohol and football. And nothing brings a football club together than when you're arm in arm with your teammates singing fucking K-San. So whenever I hear that song, I'm taken to that period of my life. And again, I've shared this with people before, and I've said, you know, if I went back, I would have done things different. I wouldn't have asked my best mate that question. I've just sucked it up and just dealt with it. But at the same time, I'm in a much better place, a much stronger person, and a much better person now because of that experience, even though I teed it on the edge.
Yeah.
But K-San is the song, and it just fills me with such loathing because... You know, the Mooseheads crowds that we mock?
Yeah.
I was that crowd.
Yeah.
And it was that song that brought that crowd together.
Yeah.
And that's why that song is important to me, because how much I hated it. Because at the time, it was the most important song. Because it bound me to my teammates. It bound me to these boys that at the time I would have done anything for. You know, and...
At the same age... I played AFL. I only played a couple of years of AFL football. But I ran from that. I never drank. I never went to presentation nights, and which is weird because cricket has a very similar drinking culture. And I was happy to partake in the cricket side of it.
Yeah.
I don't know what the difference was. Maybe because I played from age 15. My brother had played. I knew a lot of them.
You know what I reckon the difference is? Because you're right, and I play for the same cricket club as the football club as well, during the same years. And I, same drinking culture. But it's always young men in football.
Yeah.
They're young men.
I guess so, yeah. Whereas you're probably
cricket clubs, and I don't know how your club, but our cricket clubs had a mix of ages.
You played first grade to sixth grade, you're going to get 50-year-olds. You're right. That's
and there are a lot of wise heads in that group that they were good at tempering what you did.
Keep an eye on the young
until it was their bedtime, and then you just went nuts, you know.
Yeah, that's true. That's
and I think that was a key difference.
But I had like a genuine, not genuine, I guess, but I had a fear of like, no, like I come back to the pub and I feel like that's going to lead to people. Because one thing in the world I can't stand is that blokey culture, grab ass. It's freaking weird. It freaks me out.
Yeah, it is.
Of let's get drunk and touch each other and just, it's like, how are you not uncomfortable with this? You're the most homophobic group of people that you could ever meet.
And yeah, they shower together.
Yeah, they shower together. Yeah. And you know, it's really weird.
It is. And it's a confusing thing.
I just found it intimidating and I always have and I always hated it.
To go back to the song, that song represents this lovely to avoid. Alcoholic journey.
Well, that's good. That's as best an answer as I could have hoped for.
Such a shit song.
The opposite of like, why the fuck is he chasing cats up?
I knew when you read it. I would have loved to have been there.
You know what? The only worst song you could have chosen would be Summer of Fucking 69. That would have been like, if you had written that down, I don't know if I would have turned up. That might have been the tipping point.
I would have thought that could have arguably been the worst song possible that I could have listed down.
Yeah.
And I mean, would have loved to have a camcorder on
your
face.
But that's exactly right. That's exactly why I don't like that song. Yeah. It's that, in Summer of 69, it's fucking Copperhead Road, which I've never heard outside of a pub.
Yeah, yeah.
The song you mentioned before was the Pendulum song, which is the ABC News remix.
Yeah.
Which was, what, 2010,
I think?
10, yeah.
And that was my time in England. And I think there was the period of time in England where I started to miss Australia. Not to the point where I wasn't homesick. I don't think I ever was homesick.
So how many years were you in?
From 2009 to 2012.
Okay.
And yeah, I don't think I was ever homesick. But this song, it's the ABC News theme.
Yeah.
It's stuck there in the back of your mind.
Everyone knows it.
It's just one of those tunes. And that beat, that really deep bass beat that just comes in, and you just, it's like, you know, you're at the epicenter of an earthquake, you're just blown away, and it's just awesome. And again, it's one of those goosebumps every time I hear it. And you'll notice that I'm listening to it when I'm walking with my headphones on, when I'm walking anywhere.
Yeah,
you'll notice I'm listening to it because I start clapping just uncontrollably. No reason.
No.
It's just, I'm excited to hear this song. You know, it's just that's what happens. And I was in England when I came out, and I was just pumped.
Yeah.
I was just pumped. I was like, Pendulum, and Pendulum are quite big in England. And I loved going to the English people and going, they're fucking Australian.
Yeah.
You know, love it. And it was like a marker. It was a signifier for my time over there, because England did a lot of things for me. But the most important thing it did for me, I think, was it really made me appreciate being Australian.
Yeah.
And it made me sad as well to be Australian, because, I mean, I knew a lot of other Australians there, and a lot of white, you know, British ancestry Australians. And they'll say, oh, you know, they meet British people, and British people ask them about what's Australia like, and you know, the weather's amazing, why are you over here, and blah, blah.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, that's strange, because when the English ask me a question, the first question they ask me is Australia racist?
Really?
Yeah. I never got the...
That's,
you know,
fantastic.
Why would you come here when Australia's weather's great and I hear, you know, all the snakes and that are really poisonous?
Yeah. Yeah.
None of that. The first conversation people wanted to have with me was, is it true that Australia's racist as it is, or as it's portrayed? And it annoyed me. And it annoyed me that... I don't know why, if it annoyed me because I'm brown skin and they assume that that was the case. Or whether it annoyed me because people thought that was the case in Australia. And and there's an argument to say, yeah, it is. It's, I know, but I never felt the whole racism thing really keenly, apart from maybe at school, which just made me just have a thicker skin. That's the only real ramification for it. And I was sad because I wanted to be as proud to be Australian as all my white Australian friends were.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about how great AFL was. I wanted to talk about how great the weather was and the beaches. How go to Brighton Beach in England.
Yeah. Yeah, beach is horrible. Yeah.
What is this?
It's a life-changing moment of being an Australian and going to any beach in the UK and going. You know where the nicest beach I went to was in the northeast, in like Newcastle. Beautiful beach, like an actual beautiful white just North Sea.
Yeah, you can't use it. You can't enjoy it in any way, shape. No. You can go for a swim, but you have to wear a beanie and a scarf while you do it.
Yeah.
And so things like that, I couldn't have that conversation, not initially anyway. Because you know people were more caught up with perception.
It's 100%. When I worked in a bar in Leeds. That's where every question was. Why are you over here when the weather, blah, blah, blah? That's all they'd ask about.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I guess if you get a talk about how you don't think Australia is that racist, then maybe that's your source. That's way more interesting conversation than going, oh, the weather's pretty good over here too, you know?
Yeah, like, and I get that too. But when you've had that conversation, and this from my point of view, 100,000 times over and over, it's as dull for me sometimes to talk about it as it would be for someone to talk about the beach, you know, and that's cool because I'm quite fiery about the topic. I'm actually got a lot of strong values and sort of ideas around it, but I'm also conscious that sometimes the whole thing is a little bit mountain out of molehill stuff.
Yeah,
and one of the things about being an Australian that I think we need to be careful not to lose is our sense of humour and the ability to take the piss out of ourselves.
Yeah,
it's what we do. And we do it well. And we define, have a look at our terms of endearments.
Yeah.
I mean,
I've mentioned this in other podcasts, but that gets you into trouble when you've got like the terms of Kiwi and the terms of Poms.
Mm.
But the term of Paki
in
Australia is
absolutely
totally different to...
My experience with Lebo
is
in the same vein. And, you know, when I became conscious of this stuff, WOG wasn't acceptable.
No.
Whereas now...
Yeah,
you know, we're quite happy to throw that word out there because we've made movies out of it. We've made fun of it.
Yeah.
We've had WOGs step up and make, you know, Fat Pizza and all that. It's all based around that.
Soccer used to be WOG ball. When I grew up, that's what everyone called it.
Absolutely.
It's called a WOG ball.
Yeah, and that was a put down. And now it's cool. Let's go play it because everyone's playing it.
Yeah.
And I like that. I think there's scope in Australia to allow. I mean, when the immigrants from Italy and Greece came out and that they were copying it heaps after the Second World War. But then they just became part of the social fabric. And now, you know, maybe the Southeast Asians are copying it, maybe, you know, the South Asians, you know, the Indians and the like are copying it. We're definitely copying it now in the Middle East.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that same evolution occurs
within
our society and we just become part of the fabric. It's good to have a sense of humour and not to take ourselves too seriously.
Yeah.
But not without losing sight of the fact that this is a sensitive issue, especially right now because, you know, shit's hitting the fan everywhere.
Yeah.
But, you know, going over, I desperately wanted to be proud of being Australian when I was over in England. And I desperately wanted to, you know, enjoy the fact that I was Australian, an Australian in England.
Yeah.
You know, I joked about, you know, I was coming to the motherland. And people look at me and go, isn't that Lebanon? No. That's England, man. I want to go hang out with
Mother
know,
England.
I'm a, you know, what do they say? You know, they say that you capture criminals because they usually come back to the scene of the crime.
Yeah.
Isn't that why there's so many Australians in England?
So many Australians. Yeah.
I wanted to be one of those guys.
Yeah.
You know, but the conversation sort of would always go in another direction. It took a while to come back around and pendulum.
Yeah.
And Knife Party and the Cat Empire was another one at the time when I was there when they arrived. Again, that was an outlet. I could actually break through the other stuff and actually talk about Australian music.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, Silverchair was talked about and AC/DC, I guess. And you got to actually have these discussions that were not related to your skin colour or your background or anything like that. And they're good conversations to have.
Yeah.
It just didn't happen straight away. And when this song came out, like I said, it just, I pumped it. Like, I played through my work.
Yeah.
We used to work out of Acton Town Hall.
Yeah.
And the entire town hall would hear it.
So when you, so you were over there for 3 years or a bit more than 3 years.
Mm.
Did you, when you came back, like when you decided to move back, can you remember what it was like to get off the plane and to get back? Because I've heard people have strong emotions for that moment when they're like, not just coming back for a visit, but when they just come back.
Yeah, it was a bit tempered. I'll tell you about another. I went to Lebanon to stay a couple of weeks, and yeah. My dad and my sister flew out from Australia to meet me there. And my sister burst into tears when I stepped through the doors. And I've never seen my sister cry.
Yeah.
Ever. Especially not over me. And I was taken aback. Like, it was a shock. And what hit me was the fact that actually I was missed. And that was probably a year before I ended up going back for good. And when that greeting, when I received that greeting, like that was the first time I sort of started to really think outside of my bubble.
Yeah.
And what was happening back home. And because I think I had that before I went home, I don't think my return was as emotionally full on. And the other thing that happened was that the week before I flew back home, all of my mates were over in France. We were over there for a wedding. One of our mates was getting married. So I got to see him all for the first time in God knows how long. And again, tempered my return because it was just a week ago that I was
talking to you guys.
So my actual return back to Australia probably wasn't, you know, the big deal that it was. But the flip side of that coin was that I came back hating teaching. And if you had asked me if that was possible before I left, I would have said, you're daft. And there's no chance that I would hate this job. I love this job. I actually love it. But I went and taught over there, and I've come back loathing this job. So when I came back really happy that I was going to go back into an education system that I was going to enjoy again. And I was hoping I was going to enjoy again.
Yeah.
And that's where the emotion was. It wasn't seeing my family again. It wasn't seeing my friends again, because I sort of had that already, and they knew I was coming back. It was about getting purpose in my other part of my life, you know, in my work.
Yeah.
Because I lost it. You know, I came back from England hating it.
Yeah.
You know, and I can't emphasize that enough.
But I had the exact same experience, but now, surely, I'm just like, whatever, bring it on.
Yeah.
Bring it on, Australian school.
Yeah. It is a bit like that,
because I've had the worst.
You do have that attitude of, I've seen everything.
Yeah.
And nothing you can do will surprise me.
Until you spray fuck off Aussie on my door and throw panties at me, it's going to be pretty hard to beat.
And that's the thing. I mean, but what also happened is that it kind of consolidated some of my views.
Yeah.
Learning to hate education and learning to hate teaching kind of made me realize, okay, there are certain things that I'm not going to tolerate. And may have had an inflated idea of my tolerance levels in the business. And that was well and truly put to bed in England. So I've come back, and you're the first, really. Our faculty is probably the first to really see me in full flight regarding this. And I'm quite vocal, and I've got plenty to say. And I don't give a shit if you don't want to listen to it. I'll say it anyway. Well,
and very little of it's based in fact.
Very little of it. It's just emotional vitriol, And it's probably just me just wanting to say all this stuff in England and wasn't able to. So I've just brought it over with me. Really? That was my luggage. That was my 20 kilos.
Yeah.
And then
it's all out of context, and no one knows what you're talking about.
That's right.
Yeah. Someone asks you to do something, and you're like,
nah.
We're heading towards the system. Anyway, we might as well move on. I'm going to use a beautiful segue about emotional vitriol and talk about the next song on your list, which, come on, like, it's Alanis Morissette.
Yeah.
You ought to know.
You ought to know. And like I said before, I was weighing up between this and the Immigrant Song by Led Zeppelin. And I think
I'm glad you chose this one, because there's a whole lot to talk about.
This song amuses me.
Yeah.
Today.
It's 20 years old, man.
Yeah, it's the song. I don't put on. It's a song that I sing. I know the words reasonably well. I'm sort of playing through. And I always put on my biggest ocker accent when I sing the song. There's something about the song that makes me just going like this, like Kath and Kim. And just, I love doing it and singing it out loud. I do it in the shower, wherever, you know. Yeah. And it's just that one of those songs. But at the time, when I first heard it, it was something about a woman being angry that...
What is that right here?
Kind of just shocked me.
Angry Women.
Yeah.
Sold very well. Yeah. 33 million copies it sold. Take a Little Pill.
And I wonder, like this song, I think, had a very similar effect to what 50 Shades of Grey has done for women in terms of just expressing something that they don't always necessarily were allowed to or felt they could express.
Yeah.
And I just... I don't know why it sort of resonated with me, because I've never had that problem. But when I think about it, and when I've thought about it over the years, even, it was my sisters that I was thinking of. It wasn't me that I was thinking of. I was thinking about my sisters. And it's not that they had a relationship breakup and they were distraught. It was about this ability to be able to express. I was the eldest son. Everything was on a silver platter.
Yeah.
Not just from my parents, but from my grandparents, my uncles, my auntie. Like, I was the boy. I was the first one to finish high school. I was the first one to go through uni. I was the first one to get a decent job because of my qualifications. All that stuff. And I was the blessed child.
Yeah.
It was a marked difference for my sisters and the way they were brought up. And they were brought up traditional, you know, and they were brought up to, you know, not see boys. Sex was never talked about. They followed instructions. They looked after the house. They did the chores. That was their role. That was just a very traditional Lebanese thing. Just tie them in, restrict them, keep a tight leash. You know, there's no leeway there at all.
Yeah.
And it just, that song came out and it just, I just turned my attention and it just made me aware all of a sudden. And I thought, this is shit, actually. This really is. Yeah. And little things happened from there. Like when my sister started to, you know, they got to 16, you know, the eldest of the two was a year younger than me, so she basically started partying when I did. But, you know, whereas I could stay out to midnight, 1 o'clock, they had to be home by 10.
Yeah.
And, you know, during summer, sometimes the sun doesn't even set.
Yeah, 10 is, yeah, yeah? 10's
and,
pretty nice,
and yeah. That's when it gets good, and they're having to go home. And, you know, my other sister's only 2 years younger again. And so when I got my license, I actually started to, look, I'll pick them up at 10 o'clock from the parties and I'll bring them back. You know, don't worry, I'll look after it. And I'll deliberately not pick them up to 2 a.m, you know? And therefore...
Then you can't get in trouble.
They can't get in trouble.
Yeah.
But I copped it. But I was 18. Fuck you and do what you tell me. You know? That's how it worked.
Yeah.
And so, and I just felt like I needed to do that. And I think a lot of that, and a lot of other things have happened since then. My brother coming out is another. And I started to wake up and I realized that this upbringing that I had with the Lebanese... immensely backwards.
Yeah.
And really misogynistic and really slanted towards the patriarch. And I didn't like it. And I wasn't comfortable with it. And this song, I don't know, this song made that start to bubble within me in terms of I start to ask questions. And funnily enough, when you start asking one question, all of a sudden you've got 100 questions. And it went out from not just about the way my sisters were being treated, but the whole thing about my uncle and the scrapbook and this bias that he says that the Western media had. And I thought, well, hold on a second. Our attitude towards, and this is the Middle East thing, but Lebanese and our family's attitude to Israelis is general. The phrase, there's only one good Jew and that's a dead Jew, was one that was bandied about. And how can we have one standard in one hand and not apply it to the other? Have you met them all? And I actually went out, and one of the things that got my parents and my family angry with me, and really angry with me, is I actually dated a Jewish girl. I met her at a club. And, you know, she asked me if I was Israeli because at the time I had dreadlocks.
Yeah.
And she just assumed because a lot of dreadheaded Israelis existed that I might have been from there. And I told her no, I was Lebanese. And just instant curiosity.
Yeah.
I've never spoken to a Jewish person before. And that's an amazing thing. I hate them. I hate them all.
Yeah.
I've never spoken to
you. I've never spoken to you.
Yeah. And not only did I speak to this girl, I actually found her incredibly engaging and interesting. And... the best thing that we ever did was sit down. This is our first date. Our first date was me telling her my version of the Middle East conflict, and her telling me her version.
and pretty much saying to each other, you're both wrong. Yeah, you're wrong. And that's what we did. And then we just started talking and kept on talking. And in that talk about all the stuff in the Middle East, we actually realized, as a person, you're pretty bloody cool.
Yeah.
And we dated and you know, went on to have a reasonably good relationship. It wasn't great.
Yes.
There's still pressure there. Like, the more I connected with her, the less the connection existed with my family. And that stuff was difficult for me to juggle in yeah. that period from 18 to 20 before I came to Canberra. And every time you speak her name, don't you know how you told me it all till you died? Alanis Morissette and this song was the first domino for that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, and that's been a process that's taken a good 15 years where a lot of things that I've been hardwired to believe have had to be unwound and I've had to just open up my view.
Yeah.
And my view on women was key. I mean, I was classic notches on the belt kind of guy. And two things happened. One, my sister had a not very pleasant experience, and I won't go into detail with that, but it just made me change. I hated men from it.
Yeah.
And the second experience was my brother coming out and taking me to a gay bar and going into a homosexual cultural sort of center.
Yeah.
And again, the dreadlocks, like I was... This is what women feel when they go into Musos.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? I was getting stared at. I was getting harassed. I was getting felt up. Man, I'm straight. I'm not interested. And they were aggressive, you know? Wow. Is this what I'm like?
Yeah.
And that was the leap I always went to. It was like, is this what I'm like? Is this how I behave?
Yeah.
And I thought, this is fundamentally wrong.
Well, I heard,
in a lot of ways.
I heard a great quote. Which was like, this is what all men need to understand, but none of them do, is that no is the end of a conversation, not the beginning of a negotiation.
Yeah.
And that was like, huh,
yeah.
How many times does that happen? And you're like, well, how am I coming from a different angle?
Yeah.
Like, no, they've said no.
Yeah.
And they'd be...
And I think that's probably would sum me up, actually. And just meant that you needed to try harder.
Yes.
The thing that you always sort of heard.
Yeah.
And in a football culture too.
Yeah,
like
definitely.
You, I mean, football culture is an alpha male culture. So you sort of expected.
Yeah.
And you were judged and marked and sort of put on a pedestal relating to how successful you were in all of these machismo sort of elements. And women were one of those things. So it was important that I had numbers.
Yeah.
It was important that I was, you know, drawing attention and I was able to brag about it. And, I mean, that had to change fundamentally because, I mean, I was not a good person for women at all. And certain things happened. But again, I mean, that stuff was hardwired.
That's an interesting point about how the realization that you're not a good person, I think everyone needs to have that.
Yeah.
I mean, I got that after I got married, which is... pretty hard to face up to.
Yeah, right.
But I think, yeah, most... I don't know, maybe men, maybe a lot of men need to look back at, you know, things they've done that, especially with women, and go, yeah, that's
not cool.
That's not cool.
Yeah, and there's a few things to this for me, and I don't know if this is a universal sort of thing for men, but there's a strong thing about that bonding of mates.
Yeah.
And what you do with your mates and what you seem to be for your mates. And I'll go back to that this group who didn't judge me for not drinking and accept me for this. But that same group, like I said, they were settled, you know, had families, were in relationships and all that stuff. I was the guy, one and two others maybe, who was still single, still going out, still partying and still... And they would live vicariously through me.
Yeah, I get that.
Yeah, and Yeah. And sometimes, I mean, it's flattering, it's nice, it's cool, because you go in and you've got a story to tell and they're all wrapped and they're paying attention. Who doesn't like that attention?
Yeah.
But at the same time, you always feel like that's your job. So you have to turn up every week with a story to tell. And that feeds maybe some of this really poor behavior because you're so desperate to play that role.
Yeah.
And what I don't think, things that guys, I think, struggle to do, something I struggle to do, was actually just be self-aware and actually have a good look at what I was actually doing and what that actually meant to other people.
Yeah.
And not to those friends per se, but actually when I went out into the public, and actually met people and what kind of impression I was giving them. And I think that's something that is difficult to do because I don't know if it's a cultural thing, but we're so wanting, and I so desperately wanted other people to accept who I was and what I did, that I think sometimes I actually lost sight of what that actually meant and what that actually really was.
I think especially when you're younger too, you try and force people. It's almost like you're forcing them to, I don't know, you're aggressive.
Mm.
Like I always found that, like, I don't drink as much as I did before, and that any time I had any issues with drinking, it was that aggressive drinking.
Yeah.
Because then that meant I was usually aggressive to people verbally and
saying
horrible shit to people in the guise of a joke that was really close to the bone.
Yeah. And you know what? When people ask me why you don't drink anymore, it's like, I didn't like the person I became when I was drunk. But for me, what's ingrained really deeply into me is this anti-ethnic. You know, because my initial experience of school and sort of that life, that when you start to really become aware of yourself, you know, in the early adolescence, it was just a running battle because I was different.
Yeah.
So really my whole process through teenage years into my early university years was to dampen the ethnic part of me and become as much of an Australian as I could possibly become in all these bogan Australian ways that we've discussed tonight. But, you know, even the dreadlocks. Because what happened was that when I had the dreadlocks, people couldn't pick that I was Lebanese. And this is significant because this is the time of 9/11. This is the time of the gang rapes in Sydney. This was not a good time to be of Middle Eastern origin.
Yeah.
So having the dreadlocks actually protected me, because instead of coming to me and saying, you know, I had this happen to me on a train, where on a train to Broadmeadows back home from Melbourne, a girl was sitting across from me and, you know, it was just us two. The whole carriage was empty. She could have sat anywhere, but she started to sit next to me and she struck up a conversation. And this is the time when CityLink was getting built.
Yeah.
And I was checking out the buildings and I was admiring it. And we started talking about how amazing it looked because it was steadily coming back up and the pylons were going in. And it was great. Clearly, this girl was interested in me. Clearly, she was sitting there because she found me attractive and she just, oh, cool, I'm going to get a number and this is going to be great. What nationality are you? I said, oh, I'm Lebanese. She got up and walked to the other end of the couch.
Shit.
Yeah. She didn't say anything.
Yeah.
She just got up. She packed a bag and just...
There it is.
There it is.
Just summed up right there.
Yeah. And like I said, the dreadlocks. If I had the dreadlocks at the time, I would have got that girl's number.
Yeah.
Because nobody was saying, what nationality are you? Everyone was coming up and saying, can I feel your hair? Yeah, that was the shift. It was just, it's amazing where we're going with this from Alanis Morissette. But
yeah, that's what happens.
It's what it is. Alanis Morissette was that first domino in terms of just, I need to ask more questions.
Yeah.
I'm accepting too easily what has been told to me from family in particular.
Yeah.
And I just need to ask more questions about all of this. Because it turns out I'm a little bit intelligent, and when things didn't make sense, there was a reason for it, and I need to go and find out what that was. And, and she did that, and I'm again not a big fan of her.
That was a huge album, and I've written here like every car I got into, driven by a girl on her P's,
had that song.
Yeah. And strangely enough, either that or Raging Against the Machine, Killing the Name Of. I have very clear memories of getting lifts home from school with girls, and either Alanis Morissette or Against the Machine.
And like I said, I think that song is probably a similar thing to Fifty Shades of Grey. It just opened up something for women.
Yeah.
They could then just be free to express whatever it was. And
Yeah. Anger and bitterness towards men.
Yeah.
It's and weird to and think that they don't get the chance to voice that. Anyway, we're going to crack on.
That's a long two. Sorry, mate.
It's all right. I'll just edit it down to 20 minutes.
20 minutes.
All right, the last all right. one you've got here.
This is Nikki, sir.
Thanks for having me. It just plays the songs and that's it.
That's right.
The last one you've got here is The Bolero.
Yeah.
By Ravel.
Yeah.
Now, that was an interesting choice
What do you think?
What do I think?
Yeah.
I love Bolero.
Yeah.
It's
one of the greatest pieces of music.
I have to tell you the story of it, though, which always, for some reason, makes me think of it, which was when I was in year 11 or 12, my English teacher, good old Mrs. Robinson, she, I don't know why, I just remember this very clearly, she just said, I'm going to play you this piece of music, and so she played it, like the whole thing, she said, I want you to listen to how it builds and blah, 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 and she played the whole thing, and then, so then it finished.
What, 14 minutes?
Oh, yeah. It probably was the 40-minute version, right? And I think my dad had a Ravel CD too, which we'll get to. And then she plays it, and then she says, blah, 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 talking about it. It's from this movie, blah, blah, blah. And then she goes, it's really sexual, really. And I was like, everyone in the class is like, why is the teacher talking to us about sex? And she's like, you know, like it's sexual. It starts off slow and it has a rhythm to it and then it builds and builds and builds and then the climax is and then it's finished. And so that's sexual and all that. And one's like, okay, let's listen to it again. And she put it on again. So that, strangely, is my experience with that.
Well, you kind of stolen a little bit of my thunder because as a young teenager who's just starting out with sex. I don't know if this afflicted everybody, but I was reasonably rapid.
Yeah.
You know, just because I was just so excitable.
Yeah.
Just 3-4 thrusts done. And it was just bothering me because, you know, I was kind of not good in bed, you know, as a 17-year-old.
That is very rare for a 17-year-old.
Yeah, isn't it? I didn't understand why I wasn't better at it than I was.
I'm sure most 17-year-olds just go, cool, whatever, and never think about the other person.
Yeah, no. And we were under a tree often. So, despite having, exposed root systems, digging into your back, everything else was fine. Bolero. Yeah. I had sex to Bolero.
Yeah.
And I would always put it on as the song whenever I brought a girl home at UC, and I'd have it playing. And it was just to get me to 10, 15 minutes. Because I wanted to be better at it.
That's always a running joke with my mate, Felix. That's all he always said was like, every now and then you just go, man, it's the end of Bolero. Very rare. Very rare occasion. Might have been the truncated, 8-minute version, but...
Yeah, and there's certain points of the song that I was listening at. It was weird because you're meant to be paying attention to the girl, but really what I was doing was I was in autopilot.
Yeah.
And listening to the song.
Yeah.
So whatever I was doing to the girl was just and it kind of goes against what I was actually trying to do, was just get better and
being... That's true. That's interesting.
But it was all about time.
Yeah.
I just needed to make sure this was not a waste of a trip for her. So, I knew I was going to get something out of it. But so, and Bolero was just, I was training to that song, basically. And funny thing, because my view to sex was the same to football.
I'm going
to
have a hard time playing this song at the end of the section. You know, people are going to be like,
exactly. You know exactly what's going to happen at that last bar.
Yeah, I'm only going to play 30 seconds of it too, so that should help everyone out.
And look, I mean, ultimately, I saw sex like I did football.
Yeah.
Especially at that period, late teens, early 20s. And that I got competitive, but in the sense that I wanted to be good at it.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be told I was good at it. I wanted to be the boy that had that reputation.
Yeah.
Go out with Nick because, he'll look after you.
He'll
get you out. And so that's how I saw it. And I needed help because I know I wasn't good at it. I knew I had some qualities that were good and women enjoyed, but I just wasn't good at it.
Yeah.
So Bolero was part of my training. Like football and training, you know, was part and parcel of playing the game.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, and again, I had to break out of that. And that's a male, you know, alpha male sort of attitude to things, you know, that I've got to fix things. I've got to be good at things. I've got to get things done, you know. And actually, what I've learned in my later years is that actually, I just need to be with the person and, you know, actually just actually see the person that I'm with and, you know, touch them and feel them and, you know, be in the moment.
Yeah.
I wasn't like that when I was younger.
I was not in the moment with the person.
I was in the moment with the song.
Yeah.
So I knew every bar. I knew exactly what the next crescendo was going to be. I knew what instrument was coming in next. I knew what that actually meant. Okay. Thrust.
This bit, yeah. Going,
you know, and so, again, there's a major shift. But at the same time, I'm glad I'm not, you know, a three-minute wonder.
Yeah.
And Bolero is the reason why I'm not a three-minute wonder. Because, you know, just that's... I'm going to attribute it to that piece of music. Yeah,
to Bolero.
Thank you.
All right, well, we've just got the title of the... Not a three-minute wonder. Yeah. All right, well, at that, we might wrap it up at that weird, very strange conversation to finish off the lengthy conversation we've had.
Thanks, mate.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Nick.
I appreciate it, mate. Thank you.
See you tomorrow.